Hello, and welcome to today's episode of the ABCs, Authors Between the Covers. What makes successful authors tick? What does it take to sell that manuscript? Is self-publishing a good option? Or is selling your book to a big publishing house still the only way to fly? What about keeping up with your first big success? We'll talk about all this and more on today's show, hosted by journalist and publisher Hope Katz Gibbs, author of Truly Amazing Women Who Are Changing the World and PR Rules, The Playbook. Hello, and welcome to Authors Between the Covers. I'm Hope Katz Gibbs, your host. We are here today with author Tom Schroeder. He's the former editor of the Washington Post magazine, and he's written a fascinating new book called Acid Test. It's all about LSD, ecstasy, and its power to heal. Welcome to the show, Tom.
Hey, Hope. Thanks for having me.
So, Tom, you're going to also be the cover story on the October 2014 issue of our business magazine, BeIncandescent.com. And we can't wait to talk to you about this new book because I know our readers and listeners are going to be fascinated by this conversation. But before we launch into our Q&A, I want to tell everybody a little bit about you. So Tom Schroeder worked for years as the editor of the Miami Herald's award-winning Tropic magazine, which featured such journalistic luminaries as Dave Barry and Gene Weingarten. He then became the editor of the Washington Post magazine and continued to edit Dave Barry's columns as well as Gene's and Tony Kornheiser's, among others. He also conceived and launched the internationally syndicated comic strip Cul-de-Sac by Richard Thompson. And Tom has written several other books, including Old Souls, which is a study of the intersection between science and mysticism, which we actually interviewed him about a couple of years ago. And he wrote a book with former oil rig Captain John Conrad called Fire on the Horizon, The Untold Story of the Gulf Oil Disaster. His most recent editing project was the New York Times bestseller Overwhelmed, Work, Love, and Play When No One Has the Time by Bridget Schulte. So that's an amazing legacy. And now let's talk about Acid Test. So here's my first question, Tom. Booklist said of it, empty your mind of preconceptions about psychedelic drugs and enjoy the fascinating trip through the politics, science, history, and promise of these controversial chemical compounds. So clearly your research shows that LSD and ecstasy can be good for you. Can you tell us why and how?
Well, first of all, I should say that nobody in the responsible research community is arguing that people should go off and take this on their own. In fact, uncontrolled, unscreened, and unsupervised use of them can, in fact, create real problems. But and exactly how they work is something that they're still figuring out. But I can say some things about that. But first of all, it's important to understand that, when LSD was discovered in the 40s and when Sandoz Laboratories, a Swiss chemical company, began sending it around to researchers around the world, people began to instantly see that this had enormous promise for psychiatry. And for 15 or 20 years, psychedelic drugs like LSD or mescaline or psilocybin were used in therapeutic situations very successfully. And what happened was that in many cases it seemed to be the transcendent sort of mystical type experiences that these drugs induced in the people who took them that gave them insights that they wouldn't have already had and allowed them to see their problems in a light that they hadn't been able to before. It also seemed to have a property where just the issues of your subconscious that you were struggling with would come to the surface during the psychedelic experience in a way that you could deal with them in ways that you had been hiding from yourself all along. So what they found was that as people went through their session, that exactly the material that they needed to confront would emerge. And then with the help of a therapist, they could deal with that. And this is something that people said, you know, it would take 10, 15 years of traditional therapy to achieve what sometimes psychedelic sessions achieve.
Wow, That's amazing. So let's talk a little bit about the history of this drug. So talk about Albert Hofmann, who discovered LSD in 1943. He was in his 30s at the time and sort of had the first trip. Tell us about the history of this.
Well, Albert Hofmann, they were working with derivatives of a rye fungus, which in the Middle Ages had poisoning from this rye fungus when rye went bad, and people ate it without knowing what was going on. They ended up with horrible conditions where they'd have hallucinations, they'd have spasms, their limbs would rot off. I mean, really terrible stuff. And looking back in historical records, this poisoning killed probably millions of people over the centuries before they even knew what it was. But somehow they discovered that this rye fungus actually helped in childbirth, because what it did was it stopped the bleeding after childbirth, and it also speeded contractions to help childbirth proceed rapidly. So somehow midwives had known about this for generations. So Sandoz, the Swiss chemical company, was looking at ways to find other medical compounds from the active compounds it's called ergotamine was the active compound in fungus. And so they started looking at, well, what's the main active ingredient, when you start breaking it into its constituent components. And it turned out that the base of all the activity was something called lysergic acid. So Albert Hofmann was experimenting with all sorts of different, he was playing God, really, by adding different molecules to this lysergic acid to see what would happen. And he was doing this in the lab, and his 25th version, he added something called diethylamide, which is the derivative of ammonia. And so this became lysergic acid. The German word for acid is S-A-U-R-E. So you have lysergic acid and diethylamide, and that's where LSD comes from. And this was the 25th compound that he was experimenting with, so it was called LSD-25. Well, he did this, and none of the people in the lab were impressed. It had some activity with respiration and circulation, but not as much as some other drugs that they had already found. And they just said, "There's nothing here. Well, let's discard it." But one thing that they noted in their lab notes was that the animals who they'd given it to were strangely restive during this period of time after they gave it to them. But oddly, Albert Hofmann kept thinking about LSD-25 for no other reason that he could articulate than saying that he had this odd presentiment that it might have some value aside from, even though they didn't see anything. To the point where he kept thinking about this, and 5 years later, he decided to resynthesize it and give it another go. And as he was doing this, he began to have this really odd feeling of kind of lightheadedness, and the colors began to look really weird and amazingly powerful to him. And so he had to go home. And then he came back to the lab, and he was wondering what could have caused it, because he had been very careful dealing with the substance. And so he thought maybe it was the formaldehyde he'd been using. But he sniffed that, no, nothing. And he ruled out everything else, and then he realized that the only answer was that it must have come from this drug that he was synthesizing in a very, very tiny amount through the skin of his fingers, because he'd been careful. And he couldn't believe it at first, because it was such a small amount that the most potent known psychoactive chemical to that time was 100 times. You would have needed 100 times as much as he got from the LSD. So he decided that what he was going to do was he was going to test it by taking it himself intentionally. And so he took what he thought was a tiny, tiny dose of it in case it was dangerous. And he had this amazing trip where he had to go home. He had to take he had to ride home from the lab on a bicycle because this was during the war and there were no cars that they could use. And he barely made it home. And he just had this scary, fantastic experience where maybe he thought he was going crazy or maybe he thought he poisoned himself. But then, you know, he had no physical issues. I mean, the doctor came and checked him out and he was perfectly fine. And it was all in his head. And in fact, psychedelic means mind manifested. And so that's what was happening. This world was appearing to him. And so now he knew that he had discovered some amazing psychoactive chemical. And at first they thought, well, maybe it'll be useful. You know, schizophrenia is so hard to treat and it's so hard to understand that maybe this gives you an artificial experience of temporary schizophrenia, and maybe it would be good for researchers and doctors to experience this so they could understand what their schizophrenic patients were going through. So they sent this around to the labs, but what kept happening was that some of the psychiatrists and people who were in the sessions who were taking it, they didn't have a scary experience so much as a really sort of transcendent mystical experience where they, you know, felt at one with the universe and had all these sort of experiences that are familiar from the literature of people who have spontaneous mystical experiences. And they found these were very powerful experiences, maybe even life-changing experiences. And over time, when they began treating, so they thought that maybe this would help people who were having psychiatric problems. And what they found was that people who had these experiences could make basic personality changes that were sort of traditionally thought to be nearly impossible to make, at least in a short period of time. They were really more like conversion experiences than normal treatment experiences. And people would suddenly see all their self-destructive patterns as if they were laid out before them and just say, well, you know what? I can choose not to do that. And then they would just change, and their self-destructive behaviors would fall away. And things like it was used to treat alcoholism and other kinds of addiction. It was used to treat depression, anxiety, a whole range of things. And it was being used very successfully until we get to the period where suddenly it gets sort of out into the public and it explodes as a drug of abuse and people are ending up in emergency rooms, et cetera. And it freaked people out. It freaked the society out to the point where they made these draconian laws against it. And basically those draconian laws didn't stop the abuse, but it did shut down the research.
And that's what the book really centers on, is the medicinal properties, the medicinal factors of how this can help people. And there are three main characters that you illustrate this through. First is Rick Doblin, who is the founder and executive director of the Multidisciplinary Association of Psychedelic Studies. And we want to learn more about how you got involved with him, because that's articulated really beautifully in the foreword of the book. The second is Dr. Michael Mithoffer, a clinical researcher and psychotherapist who has been conducting clinical trials using MDMA, better known as ecstasy, to treat abuse survivors and those suffering from PTSD. And the third is Nicholas Blackstone, who is a Marine combat veteran who suffered from severe hallucinations and panic attacks after returning from the war in Iraq. So talk about those three characters that are obviously real people who you go back and forth with in the book and what their experience has been.
Well, what I really try to do is I realized that you could almost, the book is really a history of how psychedelic research was redeemed from this period where people were frightened of and stigmatizing psychedelics into a new period now where medical research is accelerating with really promising results. And I realized that these three people, their stories, the arc of their individual stories, would knit together to kind of really tell the history. Rick Doblin was a 21-year-old college student at a place called New College in Sarasota, Florida. And he was an unusual guy, very, very sort of, he basically grew up wanting to save the world. He had that orientation. He came from Jewish family whose relatives, some of his relatives had perished in the Holocaust. And his grandfather had been a successful businessman, and his father had been a doctor, and he realized that he was going to inherit some money, and he decided that this would allow him to free himself to, go about trying to prevent other Holocausts of the future. And this is something that he's thinking about as like a 14-year-old. So he's a very unusual 14-year-old. And he didn't, and as he went through high school, he never drank. He didn't even drink coffee and didn't smoke. So he was a very serious-minded kid. But when he gets down to New College, what he discovers is that there's this whole scene where people are staying up all night and taking LSD and dancing naked out by the swimming pool. And he had had this experience where there was this kid in high school who he thought was going to be brain damaged because he took LSD. He knew that he had taken LSD. And the kid said, well, read this book. And he gave him One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest by Ken Kesey. And so this is about Big Nurse and oppression. I don't know if you know this book, but basically Big Nurse is like a Nazi. Mm-hmm. So he really related to this, and it's a brilliant book. And then the kid said, Ken Kesey wrote that book on acid. And so this began this process where Rick was sort of wondering if maybe there was something worthwhile in that experience. So he began tripping on LSD in college, and he saw all his flaws as a person, and he really thought that maybe through LSD he could grow himself and sort of become a better person through it. And he became convinced that this was possible. And so he decided that what he wanted to do, and then he discovered the work of a man named Stan Grof, who had been one of those researchers in Europe who got the early LSD, and he had probably conducted more LSD therapy sessions than any other person alive. And he wrote a book about psychedelic therapy. So Rick decided that's what he wanted to do. He wanted to become a psychedelic therapist. But just at that point, psychedelics were being made illegal and all research was shut down. And so Rick decided that his mission in life would be to restart this research. And so he goes from being this college dropout, and then through the pursuit of trying to get this research started, he teaches himself the science of research science, and he ends up going and getting a PhD at the Kennedy School for Public Policy at Harvard because he wants to learn how to communicate with authority and to deal with all the complex issues that needed to be dealt with in order to get government-sanctioned research restarted again. So that was his arc. Then Michael Mithoffer was a sort of free-thinking young man. For a while, he and his wife went sailing around the Caribbean, and, they were kind of living on their sailboat, but then he decided, I'm not really giving back anything. I mean, it's a nice lifestyle, but, what is my purpose? So he decides to go to med school. He becomes an emergency room doctor. But then he realizes that in the emergency room, the people that he's dealing with, gunshot victims, knifing victims, people who have tried to commit suicide, that he's always dealing with the end result of really what starts out as psychiatric problems. So he decided that, A, he didn't want to just do things to patients, you know, like put tubes down their throats and stitch up their wounds. He wanted to interact with them on a personal basis, and he wanted to do it in order to help them stay out of the emergency room by not having those issues in the first place. So he decides he wants to become a psychiatrist. And Michael had had some very powerful but scary psychedelic experiences when he was a college student. So he thought, in the back of his mind, he thought, well, there's something important there, but, you know, I'm not exactly sure what to do with that. And he, too, came across the works of Stan Grof. And he became very interested in this whole idea that these altered states that psychedelics induced could actually facilitate healing. And that, in fact, in preliterate societies for thousands of years, that's how they had been used. And they had, you know, whole cultures had developed around the use of psychedelics as a thing that were both healing psychically and also helped spiritual growth. And so he decided he wanted to, like, look into that. And he actually went down to Peru and engaged in a ceremony with ayahuasca, which is a psychedelic compound that comes mainly from vines in the rainforest. And he had an experience that he felt, you know, where he got to sort of the core of his, you know, of his sort of fears and anxieties, and learned how to deal with them better. And so he came back and he decided, you know, I have all these patients with PTSD, and the current therapies just aren't successful enough. And I feel that, you know, it's possible that these psychedelic drugs might really be a breakthrough, but it's just impossible to research them. By this time, Rick Doblin had created this organization called MAPS, which is the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies. And he was trying to get research started. And so Michael met him at a conference and said, you know, I want to do research on using psychedelic drugs to heal, but I know I can't do it in this country. Where can I do it? And Rick, meanwhile, was looking. It was very hard to find a reputable psychiatrist who would take the political chance of working on this. So he said, you're my guy. We can do it here, and I'm going to help you. And so then becomes this long, really fraught process of them trying to get this through in this country. So that's where that thread's come. And then the third thread is Nick Blackston, who went into the Marines. He decided he was going to become a Marine when he was 17. He wanted to be infantry. He was the guy up in the turret of the Humvee with the 50 caliber machine gun. And, you know, he had just these horrendous combat experiences where, you know, these kids, like 12-year-old kids, would be firing at him with AK-47s, and he'd have to blow these kids away with a 50 caliber, or watching his friend bleed to death right at his feet. You know, all and constantly worrying that you're going to be, you know, get exploded by an IED at any moment. And this went on, you know, for a year and a half of constant situations like that. And when he came back, he kept having these, you know, full-blown hallucinations of people attacking him. He flew into rages for reasons he didn't understand. He couldn't sleep. He had these horrible dreams. The VA treatments were worse than ineffective. They actually made him feel worse. And he was suicidal to the point where he would sit on his bed with his service revolver pointed at his temple, just imagining that he could end it all. Wow. With one little twitch of the finger. And then, and he was thinking that he was that there was no way he was going to survive this. And then he came across a report that they were doing a study using ecstasy, MDMA, to treat PTSD in combat veterans with combat-related PTSD. And so he happened to live about 20 minutes away from where they were doing the study. So he got enrolled in that, and then the story of his treatment, and this was the study that Doblin and Dr. Mithoffer had come up with. And then, you know, that's where they all the threads join, and then the rest of the book is the story of his treatment and what happens.
Amazing. Just amazing people. And the weird sort of talking about your old books, your book Old Souls, how it's sort of that intuition brought them all together. It's just fantastic. But let's also talk about what brought you to this topic. In the foreword of the book, you give us a really good idea of what turned you on to this. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, talking about coincidence, you know, the one thing around the use of psychedelic drugs is there always seem to be these astonishing kind of coincidence going on. So when I was a student journalist at the University of Florida, I was editor of the college newspaper, which was the Independent Florida Alligator, it was called. And I also was from Sarasota. I'd grown up on Siesta Key outside of Sarasota. And I was home on break, winter break or something. And I somehow, either I stumbled on this when I was driving around, or I saw a little blurb in the local paper about this hippie who was building this fantastic house out of cedar and stone and stained glass out in the woods in east of Sarasota. And I decided that this might be an interesting feature story for the college magazine that went with our newspaper. So I went out and I interviewed this guy, and he had this pet wolf. I remember that, you know, he would stick his chin in the wolf's mouth just to show how tame and how much he trusted it. And the house was absolutely gorgeous, and he had all these like artisans working on it, and you know, he had river gravel floors, and this, he commissioned this gigantic stained glass window that shows you know, some like man with a rainbow, a white bearded man with a rainbow and a bird flying, you know, all this stuff that was really obviously psychedelically inspired. And I wrote a feature story about him, and this was in 1975. And went about my business, and when I was, you know, I went back recently and looked at the article. Psychedelic drugs were never mentioned, and yet that was the whole subtext of it, because this whole idea of people sort of not wanting to sort of just live out in the ruts that everybody had made before them, but they wanted to live their life intentionally and to experience, you know, to experience life directly, et cetera, all this stuff was floating around. And I had had some experience with psychedelic drugs in college, because outside of Gainesville, there are all these cow pastures, and psilocybin mushrooms would grow out of the cow dung there. And we'd drive out and collect the mushrooms and take them. And I never thought of this as doing it for entertainment, really. It seemed way too profound and serious for that. And I had an experience where I was completely knotted up with all sorts of anxieties and concerns about the future and concerns about myself, et cetera. And as the mushrooms started to take effect, all those concerns kept getting wound up tighter and tighter, and it seemed like such a weight on me. And then suddenly I could just see it, that these negative feelings that I was having, that there was a degree to which I was choosing to feel them, that I, you know, either because I felt sorry for myself and you know, or because I was going to avoid responsibility for dealing with things by, you know, being overwhelmed by them. And suddenly I saw, I could just see it. It was like a vision that these negative feelings were like this gigantic stone that I was actually holding to my chest with my arms. And I had this sudden perception that if you're holding a heavy stone to your chest and you can't bear the weight, all you have to do is open your arms and it falls away. And I realized that all I had to do was let go of these negative feelings and they would just fall away. And I did it. I just could see in that, you know, in that sort of psychedelic vision, I could see that all I had to do was just let it go. And I did it, and everything changed. And suddenly all these anxieties just vanished, just disappeared. I realized that, you know, that this was always the case. And that one experience, I've sort of worked on the rest of my life. It's like a muscle you develop to be able to do that. But I never would have been able to see that if, you know, on my own for the first time, to really believe that you could actually let go of those feelings if I hadn't had whatever that state, that altered state was. So, you know, then as I went on into my career and I got a family, et cetera, I stopped doing drugs because they were less available outside of college. And then, you know, I had professional and family responsibilities and it was illegal after all. So I just stopped doing it. But I never forgot that this had done something that continued to be of importance in my life, because I constantly worked on that and sort of other insights that I had had. So that was always in the background of my mind. And then 10 years later, in 1985, I had become editor of Tropic at that point. And I saw a news story in the Tampa Tribune, I believe, that about this sort of perpetual college student who was proclaiming that MDMA, which was ecstasy, was sort of the miracle drug for psychiatric therapy. And I was looking at it and I saw the picture and then I saw the name and I couldn't believe it. This was the same guy. This was Rick Doblin, the same guy who was the hippie in the woods with the wolf 10 years later. And this is what he was doing. So I sent a reporter out there to do a cover story, which we headlined Tim Leary for the 80s. And then, again, I went on with my career, and I became, and I guess maybe 12, 13 years later, I was the editor of the Washington Post magazine, and I saw a story in the New York Times about this nonprofit organization that was sponsoring the first psychedelic research ever at Harvard University since Tim Leary. And it was Rick Doblin, same guy again. I couldn't believe it. This time I decided I was going to write a story for it myself. So I did a story for the Post magazine about it. And at the time, I was aware that we were having all these soldiers coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan with PTSD. And the study that I wrote about was a study using MDMA to treat women, victims of rape and sexual abuse who had PTSD as a result. And the results were unbelievable. I mean, people who had these problems that they hadn't been able to solve, really life-threatening problems for 10, 12, 15 years through all sorts of failed therapies, in like one session, they had these like blinding flashes of insight that set them on the road to healing, even though, you know, it wasn't like that all their problems were gone. But suddenly, you know, one person said it was like suddenly they were looking at their life from a great height, and they had been thrashing through a jungle lost. And now that they could see from a height, they could see that there was a path out of the jungle. And so now that they could just follow that path until they were completely better, things like that. And so, you know, really amazing stuff. and 80% of the people on that study were would not even be diagnosed with PTSD, you know, 6 months after this treatment. And, you know, they only did the treatment a couple of times, and then 6 months, 3 years later, they still were symptom-free. So it was really an astonishing thing. And I decided I wanted to write a book about this. But I also knew that they were planning to do a study with combat veterans. And so I decided I wanted to wait until not only did they do the study, but until I could actually get some of the people who went through the study to be willing to talk to me fully. And when that happened, that's when I got the book contract.
That's amazing. Well, I want to talk a little bit more about the book contract and how that all works, but let's talk a little bit. I think we'd be remiss to not talk about the downside to these drugs, and you beautifully articulated that in the beginning of the conversation, but can you talk a little bit more about what people can and should do? I think the book will definitely, you know, light them up about this possibility of, as a healing tool, but not to do it on their own.
Oh, well, yeah, what happens is that even in a clinical situation, there are moments of real severe anxiety. People can feel like they've lost, you know, they've gone crazy, that they're never going to, you know, get their right mind back, and or they can come up with a bunch of really dark things from their subconscious. And what happens in therapy is that these are things that the therapist then, by reassuring, by sort of ensuring that nothing unsafe happens during the time of the session, and by talking through it, they can actually use these moments of fear as, that's actually becomes part of the healing process. But if somebody's on their own and goes into one of these fits of anxiety or panic, which is very common with these drugs, bad things can happen. You know, they can kind of cascade, and people can have psychotic breaks. It could cause them to act out in an unsafe way, like, for instance, get in a car and start trying to drive, or, you know, because they're not really capable of making sound decisions in that kind of state. It's really dangerous to take psychedelic drugs if you've had pre-existing mental illness. So in a clinical setting, they guarantee someone's physical safety by the presence of, you know, medical supervision. They've screened people who really it would be unsafe to take the drugs for because of previous history of mental illness, and they use these moments of fear and anxiety as part of the process of healing, rather than having them just sort of exist without anybody with professional experience to help you work through them. So for all those reasons, these drugs can, you know, if they're taken unscreened and unsupervised, they can be a real problem. Now, they're not, you know, physically, there are some rare instances where people who take psychedelic drugs can have persistent sensual distortions, sort of like a blurring of the vision, or, you know, like seeing trails when you scan a scene or something like that. That's very rare. You know, some people do have flashbacks, although most people don't experience those as being anything scary or anything. But they just sort of where something will remind them of a altered state that they were in, and they kind of will feel it for a while. Some people actually think that's pleasurable, and that's usually not a huge problem, but it does happen sometimes. But, you know, other than that, they're not physiologically dangerous, with the exception of MDMA. That's ecstasy, that frequent sort of high-dose usage of that does affect the serotonin system of the brain. Serotonin is a neurotransmitter, and it does you do see alterations in that system. However, and then there's this whole debate over how dangerous that is, that's been going on and continues to go on. And, you know, it's still an open question to some degree. But what's not an open question is the fact that used in a clinical setting in these controlled doses and in a clinic, you're only using it, you know, a handful of times. Nobody is really has any kind of reasonable case that that's does any harm at all physiologically. So I think that's, you know, I think that basically is the sort of outline of the, you know, the safety issues.
Right. So given those pros and cons, who do you think is best served by using these drugs to treat their maladies?
Well, that's a complicated question too, because on the one hand, they've had, you know, this real, so far, the clinical studies, forgetting the whole 15-year history of its actual clinical use back in the day when the standards of research weren't the same as they are now. So you could always pick flaws with the 1950s research methods. They wouldn't pass muster today, but now they're doing it with rigorous research methods. And it's showing tremendous promise in PTSD, as I've mentioned. It's also being used to help people with terminal cancer deal with these end-of-life issues and the severe anxiety and depression that often accompanies that with great success. It's being used just recently. There was a study that showed it had tremendous success in helping people quit smoking, people who'd been hardcore smokers for years. There's another study out where it's looking like it might be useful in helping people with autism develop better personal relation skills. But on the other hand, there's been studies where perfectly healthy people with no psychiatric problems have been given psilocybin, and this is really blows my mind. After that study, 70% of them put it among the top most significant five experiences of their lives, and then a portion, and then like 30% said it was the single most important experience. And so when you've got healthy people, healthy, responsible adults who, you know, who come in for these studies in a clinical thing, and they go out saying, hey, that was the most important experience of my life, it raises all sorts of sort of challenging questions about, well, what could the role of this be? Could it, you know, could there be a long-term role for people to enhance their, you know, sort of human potential and spiritual growth under controlled conditions? And of course, you know, that's what a lot of people were arguing back in the 60s. And I think the other side of that is that, you know, that kind of talk can suddenly make people want to go out and do it in the uncontrolled situations that end up being dangerous. So it's a very tricky issue. But because psychedelic therapy appears to heal, not like penicillin is a drug where if you have an infection, you take penicillin, and without any conscious participation on your part, the infection gets healed. In this case, it's the conscious participation and the experience itself is what creates the opportunities for healing and for growth. So that makes it a, you know, potentially wide range of applications since, you know, it's kind of the insights and the experience that allows people to change their behavior into something that is actually more positive and productive than what they'd been doing previously. So, I mean, it's a fascinating question, and it's by no means completely answered. But again, I think that the value that people saw in this early on is to some degree beginning to be borne out now using the sort of modern methods of research.
So if someone was interested in doing this clinically where they were in a controlled situation, how would they go about doing that?
Well, there are various studies that are looking for subjects, but, you know, like, it depends. They have certain requirements. Like, there's an ongoing study at NYU and at Johns Hopkins also for people who have terminal cancer diagnoses. So, you know, somebody with that could go on the Johns Hopkins website and see if they could qualify for the study. They're still enrolling vets with combat-related PTSD along with police officers and firefighters who have had traumatic experiences on the job that have resulted in PTSD in Midhoefer's Charleston study. They're still enrolling people in that. But it's a very small number. We're talking like, you know, a handful of dozen sort of numbers. You know, other than that, at some point in the not-too-distant future, they'll start going into phase three studies in which they'll be doing a much broader array of issues for, you know, hundreds of people in dozens of places around the country. That's phase three, and that's the phase that happens before the FDA approves it as a prescription drug. And, you know, if all goes successfully, the problem is that it's very expensive to do that. The psychedelics are still stigmatized to the degree that although the government is basically has this huge debt to all these service people who, you know, as many as 500,000 service people are coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan with PTSD. And their psychiatric and health needs are going to, you know, cost the government and us as taxpayers in the, you know, vicinity of $1 trillion over the next 30 years in giving these people the care that they earned on the battlefield and in Iraq and Afghanistan. And yet the government has not contributed one dime to further this research. And they're doing things like they're doing an Indiegogo campaign to raise, you know, money in $50,000 segments to continue this research. And at this rate, it's going to take at least a decade and possibly longer before they could possibly get through the phase three trials and have this treatment being available on prescription. And that's what really frustrates me is that, you know, to me, if a rational leadership was running the Department of Defense, you know, they have enough money in their couch cushions lost to fund this research and to speed it through the process to where they could be sure that it was effective and to get it to all the people that need it. But that's not happening, and it's not happening because, you know, that this, you know, 40-year-old stigma that got attached to psychedelics in the late 60s. And it's a real shame, and I'm hoping that acid tests will help people see how foolish that is.
Well, I have no doubt that it will. It's such a good book, and you're such a good spokesperson for this, logically thinking through it. So before we let you go, talk a little bit about how you choose the topics for your books. As I said earlier, I'm a big fan of Old Souls, which I think is a really fascinating topic and a book. You come at it from a journalistic point of view, which I really appreciate. So how do you pick these topics? Because they all seem to be kind of edgy, things that people are slightly frightened of, and you take a really balanced approach to them.
You know, it's a really good question. But, you know, I thought a lot about this because to some degree these topics kind of choose me. You know, that's the way it feels sometimes. But writing a book is such a huge investment of time and energy, and it's so difficult for me, you know, painful in many ways. The pain mostly comes from fear of failure and fear of not doing justice to a topic, that I really want to write books about things that are, in the end, kind of hopeful. I don't think I could, on top of all the pain and difficulty of writing a book, tack on a book that ends up being really sort of depressing that would be just be too much, a double whammy. So, and also, I guess I have a deep conviction. My biggest impression of life in general is that it's just this completely awesome mystery. And so I like to pull at little corners of that mystery and say, what can be known about this? Can we really nail this down and articulate what's going on here? So I think that in both the cases of Old Souls, where there were small children who were claiming memories that sounded like previous life memories, and they were so small that, you know, you couldn't think that they were faking, and you would think, well, it's just a childhood fantasy, except that they kept having this information about people that they had no way of knowing that turned out to be accurate. So, and I basically followed this psychiatrist at the University of Virginia, Ian Stevenson, who had been sort of investigating this for 40 years, and I went on field trips with him to India and to Lebanon, where there were a lot of these cases sort of spontaneously popping up. And I just, you know, I just said, okay, well, let's look at this. Let's not immediately assume it's bunk. This guy's a serious guy. He was the head of the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Virginia. And so, you know, I just, that was really fascinating. And then on this other thing, there was this idea that there were these transcendent states that could sort of give you a view of life that helped you become a better person. That seemed incredibly hopeful to me as well. So I guess those are, you know, two of the things that that go into it. And you know, I guess I just want to have a strong, positive feeling about the subject, almost of love for the subject, because that's the only thing that could sustain me through this sort of god-awful process of writing.
Yeah, no, I feel that. I just finished my book, which you're in, PR Rules, the Playbook. And yeah, it's a painstaking thing. And then once you birth the book, right, then you have to sell the book. That's all other process.
That's why I appreciate an interview like this so much, is that I don't have to do it in a soundbite. I was on Sanjay Gupta, MD, on CNN the other day, and you know, and I like, there was like a 40-second burst of me speaking, and somehow that had to represent the whole book. And so you're constantly regurgitating these sound bites, which you've just spent, I've just spent 2 years trying to put everything in perfect context, to tell the story completely, fully, to develop characters, to let, you know, to let the events speak for themselves rather than telling people what to think. And then when you go to sell the book and to publicize it, you're doing the opposite. You're taking things out of context. You're reducing them rather than presenting them fully, and you're telling people what to think. So I really appreciate the opportunity to speak at such great, and I hope not too boring length about this.
Oh, not boring at all. It's actually more than fascinating, especially if it's a healing tool that can help people. But, you know, the politics of it, it gets blocked at that level. But I do think your book will open eyes and ears to what is possible. So do you have a topic for the next one, or are you just full in this one?
I do actually have a topic, and I've started working on it already. But I'm kind of ground to a halt here while I'm dealing with, you know, gratefully, the interest, the media interest in acid test. So I'm not complaining, but it's sort of shut down the new book for a while.
Do you want to share that title, or is that top secret?
Well, the working title is The Most Famous Writer Who Ever Lived, an investigative memoir. And it's sort of a complicated topic. My grandfather was a Pulitzer Prize winning novelist named McKinley Canner. And I grew up with him, and and he died when I was an adult, when I was a young adult. He died 3 days after my first daughter was born, in fact. And my mother was always trying to tell me things about his life, but like most kids, I really didn't want to hear it. You know, it didn't seem relevant, blah, blah, blah. And of course, now that my mom's gone, and my uncle and her brother also is gone, and of course my grandmother died not long after my grandfather, I find myself wanting to know all this stuff about him, and there's nobody to ask. I mean, he was a Pulitzer Prize winning author. I'm a writer. He loved nature. I love nature. There's all these connections that I didn't really appreciate fully at the time. And, you know, he was a famous man of his time, but it's really no different than everybody else who has, I think, who don't really grow to have this sort of urgent need to understand where they came from in terms of their ancestry until often it's too late really to do anything except, you know, these very sterile deals like, you know, get on Ancestry.com and you get these really horribly fragmentary records that might give you little tantalizing hints, but they don't really tell you much. But I have this unique case because the relative that's most interesting to me happens to have 25 miles from my house in Northern Virginia. He happens to have like 180 boxes filled with thousands of documents, letters, manuscripts, newspaper articles, magazine articles, tapes, at the Library of Congress, where they had chosen him to sort of catalog in their collection of authors' papers. And he'd also wrote three autobiographical books, which I had never read. And I hadn't been any interested in any of this stuff. And so I have this unbelievable opportunity to, right now, go in and get to know my grandfather on this incredibly detailed and intimate basis. And in so doing, I hope to answer questions about why do we care who our ancestors are? What does it mean to us? What's the science of what we get from our ancestors in terms of genetically or otherwise? And that's what the next book's about.
Oh, it's fascinating.
You know, there's a lot of sort of love tied up in that as well. My grandfather was a very flawed man, but this is making me feel much closer to him, and it's interesting. And I've just started. You know, the stuff I found out already has been amazing, and I've barely dented it yet, so it's going to be really interesting.
Fascinating. Well, who isn't flawed? So, you know, that kind of makes people even that much more interesting, I think. But actually, my next book is called Intuition Rules, to follow up on PR rules. So I'd love to interview you for that, about your intuition and how intuition guides us when we're paying attention to it, especially, but even when we're not. So we'll have to talk about that offline. But my last question to you is about the New York Times bestseller Overwhelmed, which you worked on with author Bridget Schulte. So tell us a little bit about that book, and also tell us how someone gets the amazing Tom Schroeder to edit their book.
Well, in this case, this was just as I was, I'd left the Post and I was looking for editing projects at the time. And I knew Bridget. Bridget had written for me when I was at the magazine, and I really thought she was a terrific writer and a superb reporter. And she wrote this really interesting story in the magazine about, she feels that she lives a scattered existence, you know, that she has so many things that she's got a job, she's got kids, she's got a husband, she's got a household, and she always feels overwhelmed with all that she has to do, like so many other people. And so she saw an article about this time researcher who said, just made the flat statement, that people complain a lot about how busy they are, but truly they have like 30 hours of leisure a week, and, you know, they have nothing to complain about. And she said, that's crazy, 30 hours of leisure a week? I feel like I don't have even 5 seconds. So she wrote the story. She went and interviewed this guy and kept a time diary where he was going to prove to her that she had 30 hours of leisure. It turns out that one of those hours was when she was trying to take her child to a after school activity. Her car broke down on the highway, and she was, had to wait by the side of the road for a tow truck. He classified that as leisure time. So anyway, I sent her a message. I said, you know what? You should write a book about this. This is great. And so we met, and we kind of, and she says, well, what would the book be? And we kind of talked it out, and we kind of came up with a plan of just this, of it making this journey of trying to understand why we all feel so overwhelmed about things. And, you know, to do the cultural history, the sociology, the science of it. And so we kind of had this rough outline. And then as she went into and started to investigate this, she discovered that there really is all this scientific study of this issue and all these amazing statistics and things that people were finding out that nobody had really pulled together in one place. So then she ended up writing this really terrific book, and you know, and then we went through it, you know, basically page by page together, and tried to, you know, the real challenge was to make it with all this sort of chewy stuff in it, to make it as readable and as fun to read as possible without people feeling like they were reading a textbook. And I think we really achieved that. And, you know, I'm very proud of what she accomplished with that book. And, you know, and boy, you know, it really hit a nerve as I knew it would from the very start.
Excellent. Well, I can't wait to get my hands on that book. So Tom Schroeder is the author of Acid Test, LSD, Ecstasy, and the Power to Heal. Highly recommend you pick it up, not just because of the topic, which is fascinating, but because of the way he wrote it. It's just beautifully done and just really just something that you, it's a page turner. So that's it today for Authors Between the Covers on the Incandescent Radio Network, the voice of entrepreneurs. What's your story? If you have a good one, send me an email at hope@incandescentpr, and that's incandescent with a K because we're all writers here. Continue to check out new shows that we post every week on Incandescent Radio. We look forward to talking to you soon. That's it for today's episode of the ABCs, Authors Between the Covers. Hosted by journalist and publisher Hope Katz Gibbs, author of Truly Amazing Women Who Are Changing the World and PR Rules, The Playbook. Be sure to check back next week on the Incandescent Radio Network for another interview with a successful author who is happy to share their story. Here's to writing your heart out and keeping your dreams alive. Thanks so much for listening.